had gunners. The women kept the spares ready and loaded. As soon as the men stepped back, a freshly loaded gun was in their hands, while their wives set to work reloading the fired pieces. With that advantage, Antonina's cohort could manage a rate of fire which approached that of Wellington's men. As the battle wore on, of course, the rate would drop quickly. After a few rounds had been fired through the crude arquebuses, gunpowder residues fouled the bores. The weapons had to be cleaned before they could be reloaded, and even efficient Syrian wives couldn't do that instantly. Still. Fire! She heard Euphronius shout. The third line discharged their pieces. The only reason her troops were not maintaining a faster rate of fire was simply to let the clouds of gun smoke clear away sufficiently to aim. Had there been a strong wind blowing, they could have been hammering the Arabs almost ceaselessly. Antonina cursed the light desert breeze. The curse seemed to be effective. A sudden gust blew a great hole in the clouds. The gap was closed within seconds by the first rank's second round of fire. But in those seconds, Antonina saw the carnage. By now, just as she had experienced in her fight in the kitchen, Antonina was feeling nothing beyond controlled fury. But even with battle lust burning in her veins, she was glad that the scene was filtered through dim moonlight. The shrieks coming out of that murky mass of struggling men were blood-curdling enough. That's gotta be pure horror. The thought was at the edge of her mind, however. At the forefront came recognition that the enemy had recovered enough to change tactics. Wails of agony were overridden by frantic shouts and commands. Murky movement blurred, poured to the sides. They're going to the flanks, Bellerda shouted, loud enough to be heard all through the Roman camp. On the heels of that baritone shout, Antonina heard Menander's high tenor. The young cataphract was shifting his pikemen, shoring up all four sides of the camp. Seconds later, Euphronius did the same. The commander of the cohort had concentrated half his musketeers on the southern flank of the camp facing the hill. Now he began moving units to the other three sides. Within 2 minutes, the Roman formation was that of a classic infantry square, bristling like a hedgehog with muskets and pikes. The Arabs were swirling all around the camp, attacking on every side in small lunges and sallies. For the first time, the pikemen went to work. Euphronius, for all his youth, was too canny to waste entire salvos on small clots of enemy cavalry. The threat of those shattering salvos in the long run was all that was holding the enemy at bay. If the Roman musketeers fired too often, their weapons would become hopelessly fouled. So he waited patiently until he saw a large enough cluster gathering. Then, and only then, did the gun smoke clouds fill the air. In the meantime, the pikes were busy, keeping at bay the small groups of Arabs, sometimes one man alone, who tried to rush the Roman lines. Keeping busy meant, for the most part, simply standing their ground. Not often were the blades of the pikes actually needed. That was due to cowardice on the part of the men facing those pikes. No one doubted the courage of the Bedouin or their willingness to hurl themselves onto the Roman lines. But it is a simple fact, often glossed over by historians and always by poets and bards, that horses and camels, level-headed, sensible, sane, rational creatures, cannot be forced onto a wall of spears. Any number of camels, either from accident or from being half-crazed by wounds, did stumble against the pikes. The pikes brought them down and their riders with them. But the great mass of the beasts shied away, despite the shrieking commands of their supposed masters. Antonina, after a few minutes, felt her tension easing. She had been told, assured by her husband and by Morris and Ashot, that this would be true. Still, seeing is believing. Stand your ground, love, her husband had told her. Just stand your ground with pike and hand cannon. No cavalry in the world will be able to break you unless they break your will. Artillery could, but you won't be facing that where you're going. Many things about herself Antonina had doubted over the years. Never her will. She was a small woman, but she had a spine to match Atlas. So, as the battle raged, Antonina found herself doing exactly what Ashot and her husband and Morris before him had told her to do. Just stand there looking calm and confident. Shout the occasional words of encouragement, whistle a tune, whatever, as long as it's not a giggle. She only had to fight down a giggle once. Her maid Coutina, having no duties of her own in battle, had still insisted on staying at Antonina's side. The time came when Coutina nodded sagely, as if some inner suspicion had been confirmed.
I knew it, she said.
The young Egyptian maid glanced at the wall of pikes and muskets, dismissing them serenely.
They're scared of your giant tits, is what it is. That's why they won't come any closer.
At the very end, Antonina learned another lesson. Her husband, and Morris, and Ashot had told her of this one, too, but she had forgotten or never quite believed. Battles are unpredictable things, chaos incarnate. The Bedouin finally broke, screaming their frustration. Thousands of Arabs pounded away from the camp, fleeing into the desert. But by some strange eddy, a large cluster of enemy cavalrymen suddenly hammered into the southern flank of the Roman square. Since the first few moments of the battle, when the soldiers facing the hill had borne the brunt of the attack, their fight had been easy. If nothing else, the great mound of human and camel bodies in front of them kept most of the Arabs at bay. Now, coming from God knows where or how, a knot of some 20 Bedouin thundered at the line. The line had been thinned too far. The Roman flank didn't break, but it did crack. 3 Bedouin made it into the camp itself. Ashot's cataphracts, mounted and held in reserve, started moving toward them. Before the cataphracts could reach them, 2 of the Arabs were felled by gunshots. The 3rd Arab's mount was brought down by a pike. The Bedouin warrior sprang off the collapsing camel like a nimble acrobat and rolled to his feet. Not 6 yards from where Antonina was standing, alone except for Coutina. The maid screamed and scuttled behind Antonina. Drawn by the sound, the nomad turned his head. An instant later, he bounded toward them, his curved sword held high. The man was shrieking like a berserk. Antonina never even thought to draw her cleaver. Against street thugs, that trusty blade had done wonders. But it would be as effective as a whittling knife against the man charging her now. She snatched the hand cannon off her shoulder. For a moment, she fumbled with the dual hammers and triggers until John of Rhodes' endless hours of training bore fruit. With her finger firmly on the rear trigger, she cocked the left side hammer, leveled the gun, and fired. As always, the blast was deafening, and the recoil half spun her around. But she ignored the pain, wasn't even aware of it, in truth. Frantically, she brought the weapon to bear again. She was astonished to see that the Arab was still standing. Her first shot had smashed his rib cage. The man's right side was covered with blood. Antonina could see a jagged rib protruding, glistening in the moonlight. The Bedouin didn't even grimace. He'd stopped shrieking now. His face seemed calm, like a death mask. The man reached across his body with his left hand and pressed the horrible wound, holding his ruptured side in place. Then he began plodding toward her. His sword was still in his right hand. For an instant, Antonina was paralyzed by the incredible sight. Then she went berserk herself.
Fuck you,
she screamed. She sprang forward and jammed the muzzle against the Arab's chest. The fury of her charge was so great that the small woman actually forced the man back 2 paces, driving him with a hand cannon by rage of body while her mind, as cold as a kitchen icebox, went through the trained sequence. The Bedouin raised the sword. Finger on front trigger. Cock the right side hammer. She pulled the trigger. Again, the recoil hammered her aside. Antonina was oblivious to the pain. Still shrieking obscenities, she spun back and swung the heavy barrel at the Arab's head. The gun swept through thin air. The momentum of the frenzied swing spun Antonina clear around. She stumbled off balance and fell on her butt. The heavy cuirass drove her down. She stared at her opponent. The man was lying on his back just a few feet away. She had swung at nothing, she realized. The second shot had ruptured the Arab's heart and probably his spine with it. He had fallen even before she spun around. Finally, pain registered. Her hands hurt. Her arms hurt. Her shoulders hurt. Her ass hurt. Even her breasts hurt, where the brass armor had impacted them in her fall. Ow. She muttered. A moment later, Coutina was at her side, kneeling, clutching her. The clutch, unfortunately, the desperate squeeze of a terrified kitten, was right across her breasts, pressing the armor further into the poor bruised things.
Ow!
Almost desperate herself, she tried to pry Kutina loose, or at least to shift the girl's anaconda grip a little lower down. A Shoat loomed above her. Antonanna stared up at him. Well, the battle's won, announced the cataphract. Total victory. We won't see those Arabs again. Neither will Abraha. Ashot didn't seem ecstatic at the news. To the contrary, his expression was grim and condemnatory. I told you so, he snarled, glaring at the body of the dead Arab. Two more cataphracts came up behind Ashot. They seemed to loom over the stubby Armenian as much as he loomed over Antonina. Huge men. Antonina recognized them. They were named Matthew and Leo. They were the two cataphracts whom Ashot had proposed as her bodyguards when the expedition left Alexandria. Antonina had spurned the proposal. She hadn't been able to explain why at the time, even to herself, or hadn't wanted to, at least. She knew that her husband had bodyguards, Valentinian and Anastasius, as a matter of fact, who were universally considered the best fighters in the Thracian Bucellarii. But for Antonina, no, it hadn't been necessary, she felt. Unlike Belisarius, who led his men in combat, Antonina had no intention of actually fighting, and there was a stubborn, mulish part of her which had resented the idea. What am I? A little girl who needs chaperones? Does that offer still stand? She croaked. Ashot snorted. He gave Matthew and Leo a wave of the hand. You've got a new job, lads. About time, she heard Matthew mutter. Leo said nothing. He almost never did. He just reached down his bare paw-sized hand and lifted Antonina to her feet. Antonina stared up at him. Leo was the ugliest, scariest-looking, most brutish man she or anyone else had ever seen. His fellow cataphracts called him the Ogre, when they weren't calling him the Ox, that is, on account of his extremely limited intellect. But they never called him either name to his face. Such a handsome man, thought Antonina. I can't think of better company. Antonina's maid was still clutching her. Leo had lifted both of the women with one hand. Kutina's grip shifted again. Ow, hissed Antonina. But she didn't pry the girl off. She just patted her hand reassuringly while she took her own comfort staring at an ogre. Her ogre. Chapter 17. Kaushambi, Summer, 532 AD. You are disturbed, Nandalal, said Great Lady Sati. The young Malwa noblewoman leaned back in her plush, well-upholstered chair. Her ring-heavy fingers stroked the armrests, but her austerely beautiful face was completely still. Something is troubling you. The Malwa Emperor started hearing those words. Skandagupta rolled his fat little body side to side on his ornate throne, shifting his eyes from Lady Sati to Nandalal. As always, when the Malwa Empire's highest council met, the room was unoccupied, except for those three people and the special guards. The guards, recruited exclusively from the distant land of the Khmers, were all devotees of Link's cult. Seven of them were giant eunuchs, kneeling in a row against a far wall of the chamber. Their immense bodies were naked from the waist up. Each held a bare tulwar in his hands. The remaining two guards were assassins. Those, garbed in black shirts and pantaloons, stood on either side of the chamber's entrance. Nandalal was frowning, but silent. Emperor Skandagupta prompted him. If something is troubling you, cousin, speak up, he commanded. I can't imagine what it is. Skandagupta reached for the cup of tea resting on a side table next to his throne. Best news we've had in months. Belisarius has finally been beaten. Lady Sati shook her head. The gesture carried a certainty far beyond her years, as if she were already possessed by the divine being which would someday inhabit her body. But the certainty was simply born of habit and training. Sati had spent more time in the company of Link than any other person in the world, other than her aunt Holy, of course. But Great Lady Holy was no longer a human being. Holy was nothing now beyond Link's sheath. He hasn't been beaten, she said. simply driven off for a time, there is a difference. Finally, Nanda Lal spoke. Quite a difference, he growled in agreement. The spymaster took a deep breath. But it's not Belisarius who concerns me at the moment. It is Demodera. The Emperor's eyes widened. Lady Satis did not. You're concerned about the arms complex in Marv, she stated. Nanda Lal extended a thick hand, wobbling it back and forth. In itself, no, not much, anyhow. We discussed that matter weeks ago, you recall, when we first discovered the fact. Yes, we did, interrupted the Emperor. And we agreed that it wasn't worth making an issue over. Skandagupta shrugged. It is against Malwa law, true, but we gave Demodera a most thankless task, and can hardly complain when he improved his odds. The Emperor fixed narrow, fat-shrouded eyes on Nanda Lal. So why the sudden concern? Forcefully. I myself am very partial to Demodera. He is far and away our best military commander, energetic and practical. Which is precisely what bothers me, countered Nanda Lal. Your Majesty, he added, almost as a casual afterthought. Nanda Lal reached to another side table and picked up a scroll. He waved it before him. This is a report from a man named Pulumai, which supplements Lord Demodera's account of the recent battle in the Zagros, where Belisarius was beaten. The Emperor frowned. Pulumai? Who's he? Never heard of him. He raised his cup toward his mouth. Nanda Lal snorted. Neither had I. I had to check my records to verify his claim. He drew air into his nostrils. Apparently, Pulumai is now my chief spy in Demodera's army. Skandagupta's cup paused before reaching his lips. What happened to Ishanavarman? He demanded. He's dead, came Nanda Lal's harsh reply, along with all my top agents. Pulumai succeeded to Ishanavarman's post because he is the most highly ranked survivor. Again, that deep-drawn breath. It seems that Belisarius' cavalry raided Demodera's camp during the battle. Nanda Lal tapped the scroll in the palm of his left hand. So at least this report claims. I do not doubt the claim, not insofar as the casualties are concerned, that is. Their actual cause may be otherwise. Lady Satis's fingers came to a stop. They didn't clench the armrests, not exactly, but the grip was very firm. You suspect Demodera, she stated. Her quick, link-trained mind sped beyond.
Narses.
Yes, the entire affair is too convenient. Again, Nanda Lal lifted the scroll. This, combined with the arms complex, is making me uneasy. Abruptly, Skandagupta drained his cup and set it down, rattling on the side table. I still think it's nonsense. I've known Demodera since he was a toddler. That's a practical man if you'll ever meet one. And he's not given to ambition beyond a reasonable measure. Slowly, Nanda Lal shook his head. No, Emperor, he's not. But practicality is a malleable thing. But his impractical one day may be practical on the morrow. As for ambition, he sniffed. That, too, changes with the tide. When Satis spoke, her voice was low and calm.
Your fear is for the future, then, not the immediate present. A possibility.
Yes. Nanda Lal paused. Yes, that. I do not propose to take action at the moment, but I think we shouldn't close our eyes to the possibility, as you call it. Lady Satis shrugged.
It's a simple enough matter.
She leaned toward the Emperor.
Bestow great honors on Demodera, Skandagupta, and riches. Hold a ceremony within a week. Among those riches will be a mansion here at the capital, very near to this palace.
She smiled thinly. Among those honors will be the expectation that Demodera's entire family will take up residence therein, and stay there. Skandagupta squinted, then smiled his own thin humor.
Hostages. Yes, that should do nicely. Demodera dotes on his children.
Still, Nanda Lal seemed unhappy. But after a moment, he shook off the mood. His next words were almost cheerful. Menandakatra's siege guns should be arriving at Deagiri very soon. Within 2 weeks, three at the most.
Finally, exclaimed the Emperor.
His eyes narrowed. That should do for Raghunath Rao. I look forward to seeing his skin sack suspended in my feast hall. Fat folded further. The eyes became mere slits. And Shakuntala's. I will hang her right next to her father.
Shakuntala will take a bit of time, cautioned Sati, even after we take Deagiri. She looked at Nanda Lal. We must tighten the blockade of Supara. Make sure the rebel empress doesn't make her escape.
The spymaster scowled. I'm afraid that's impossible. We don't have the naval forces available, not with Aksum to contend with.
A pity, muttered Skandagupta, that we didn't catch Prince Aeon with the rest.
He shrugged.
But I don't see where it matters. Even if Shakuntala escapes after we take Deagiri, where can she go?
Only to Ethiopia or Rome, where she will be nothing but an impoverished exile.
The Emperor nodded towards Sati. Just as Link said long ago, without Maharashtra, Shakuntala is nothing but a nuisance.
Sati nodded grudging agreement.
True, although I would prefer to see her flayed.
Whatever we do, sneered Nanda Lal, we certainly won't make the mistake of handing her over to Venandakatra again. Dead or exiled. That's it. The spymaster reached up and stroked his nose. As always, the feel of that crushed and mangled proboscis stirred his fury. Belisarius had done for that. Since there was no way at present to vent his feelings for Belisarius, Nanda Lal transferred his cold rage elsewhere. One last point, he snarled, before we end this meeting. The rebel bands in Bihar and Bengal are growing bolder. I recommend
more impalings, snapped the Emperor. Line every road with the bandits. I agree, chimed in Great Lady Sati. The male ones, anyway. Better to turn their women over to the soldiers before auctioning them to the whoremasters. Add defilement to destruction. That will cow the peasants.
Nandalal's snarl of fury slid into something resembling a leer.
Not enough, he demurred. It's too hard to catch the bandits in the forest.
He bestowed the leer on the Emperor. Since all the news is good, Belisarius defeated, Deagiri about to fall, I see no reason that half your Imperial Guard can't be released for a campaign.
The Emperor smiled, grinned. Excellent idea. The Yatai are getting restless anyway from garrison duty here in Kaushambi. A campaign in Bihar and Bengal would do them good.
Skandagupta leaned forward, planting his hands on his knees.
What do you have in mind? A punitive campaign right through the countryside?
He barked a laugh.
Yes, sweep everything like a knife. Cut a swath 20 miles wide, from Pataliputra to the Bay of Bengal. The hell with hunting for bandits. Just burn everything, kill everyone.
Another barked laugh.
Except the women, of course. My Yetai will have a better use for those.
Nanda Lal leaned forward to match gazes with the Emperor.
I was thinking of 2 swaths, actually. One, just as you say, starting at Pataliputra. The other...
There came a knock on the door. Nanda Lal paused. One of the assassins opened the door and peered through. A moment later, he turned to the Emperor and announced, Sire, your lunch is here.
Ah, exclaimed Skandagupta. Excellent.
He smacked his hands together.
Let us eat. We can develop our plans over the meal.
Food will sustain us, concurred Sati. This will be a long session.
Nanda Lal's leer returned.
Yes, but the discussion will season the meal. I like my food hot and spicy.
Chapter 18. Maharashtra, summer, 532 AD. Irene stared nervously at the Malwa milling around the impromptu field camp which Ezana's soldiers had set up alongside the road to Deagiri. There appeared to be thousands of them, especially leering Yetai who were making no attempt to hide their ogling of her. Muttered phrases swelled from the mob. The content of those coarse words wasn't quite audible, but their meaning was more than clear enough. Like surf, frothing lust. Azana's 400 Sarwen, standing guard with their spears in hand, reminded her of a pitiful dike before a surging ocean, a child's sandcastle with the tide about to come in.
Why did I ever agree to do this? Irene demanded of herself.
Herself babbled reassurance.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. That was then, this is now. Get a grip on yourself, woman. The whole idea was to distract them, which has definitely been done.
Sure has. I bet they'll even be more distracted when all 4,000 of them start gang-raping me.
Wonderful. You and your husband, Azana, are supposed to be envoys from the King of the Vandals, seeking an alliance against Rome. Surely they wouldn't. Surely, my ass. Do those drooling thugs look like diplomats to you? Whoever came up with this insane scheme? Well, actually, you did.
Thanks for reminding me. I forgot I'm an idiot.
It's a good plan, herself repeated stubbornly.
Herself reminded Irene of one child reassuring another that there really aren't any monsters as the ogre stuffs them into his gullet.
I'm an idiot. Idiot, idiot, idiot. This is the stupidest plan.
Azana entered the small pavilion, not much more than a canopy, really, shielding the richly garbed Vandal noblewoman from the blistering sun. Her noble African husband had to stoop in order to keep his elaborate ostrich plume headdress from being swept off. Good plan, he grunted as soon as he straightened. Azana gazed placidly on the Malwa soldiery swarming around them. In the far distance, to the north, the first of the siege guns in the column was now visible, being painfully hauled another few feet south to Deagiri. Will you look at that rabble? They demanded. They make Bedouin look like a Macedonian phalanx. The officers are worse than the men.
Don't remind me, snarled Irene.
She glanced apprehensively at the cluster of officers sitting their horses nearby. The officers were perched a few yards up a slope, giving them a better view of Irene than that enjoyed by the common troops. Behind them reared the crest of one of Maharashtra's multitude of ridges. The officers were ogling her even more openly than the Yetai. She saw one of them say something, followed by a round of leering laughs.
What is wrong with these animals? She demanded, half angrily and half nervously. Haven't they ever seen a woman before? If I looked like Antonina, I might understand it. She could make the sun stop in its tracks. But I'm...
She gestured at herself. Again, anger was mixed with apprehension.
I'm not ugly, I suppose, but with my big nose?
Azana chuckled. You are quite an attractive woman, Irene, in my opinion, but it really doesn't matter. He hooked a thumb toward the Malwa. This is why we agreed to the plan, Irene. If you hadn't volunteered to come, we never would have considered it. Kungus and I both knew what would happen if the Malwa encountered a large party of foreigners claimed to have been shipwrecked on the coast. They're not diplomats. They would have just attacked us on general principle, even if they weren't guarding their precious siege guns. He gazed at her with approval. But with you here, all dressed up in such finery, his gaze, falling on her bosom, became very approving. Such provocative finery, scandalous the way foreign women dress. And they're all sluts, those heathens. Everybody knows it. Irene scowled. Those monkeys know as much about Vandals as I do about... She groped for a simile, but couldn't find an appropriate one. With her voracious reading habits, Irene couldn't think of any subject that she didn't know more about than Yetai and Malwa soldiers did about the people and politics of North Africa. Azana grinned. They know Africa is a land of black people. He cupped his hand under his chin as if presenting his ebony face. And if the woman is pale and beautiful, so much the more exotic.
I am not beautiful, insisted Irene.
Azana, still grinning, shook his head. Then, nodding toward the Malwa soldiers, gawking at her. You look beautiful to them, woman. After weeks on the road, struggling through India's heat and dust, you look like Aphrodite herself. Again, he admired her bosom. Especially your tits. Even as nervous as she was, Irene couldn't help but chuckle. She glanced down at the objects in question, which were almost entirely visible due to the cut of her tunic. She had overseen the seamstresses in Supara herself. blending Roman style with what she remembered of the costumes of Minoan women painted on vases. The small amount of skin still covered, a fifth at most, simply framed, supported, presented, and emphasized the splendid remainder.
It is impressive, isn't it? Makes me look like Antonina, almost.
Izana's grin faded to a simple smile.
It was bound to happen, Irene. You've never been a soldier on a long, arduous march. Even disciplined Sarwen or Roman cataphracts would be ragged in their ranks with every man eager to get a look. Hot, tired, aching feet and butts. Most of all, bored, especially since Rao stopped attacking the column many days ago.
The smile became a sneer, cheerfully bestowed on the mob surrounding the Ethiopian camp.
Those soldiers? Pah!
He rubbed his hands with satisfaction.
No, it worked just like you planned.
400 Sawin, some Syrian gunners disguised as slaves, and one Roman woman have completely distracted an army 10 times their number. Stopped them in their tracks, diverted their attention, disintegrated their formations. His eye caught movement to the north. He barked a laugh.
Look, even some of the troops dragging the guns are charting our way.
Oh, marvelous, hissed Irene.
Gloomily.
At least I'm not a virgin.
She eyed the leering mob and the artillery soldiers hastening down the road to join them.
Step aside, Messalina, she muttered. I think I'm about to exceed your exploits. Put them completely in the shade, in fact.
Izana chuckled.
I'm not sure who Messalina was, but if...
Humor remained in his eyes, but Izana's face was suddenly stern and solemn.
You are a bold woman, Irene Makrombolitisa. Hold fast to that courage and set aside your fears. No one will harm you. Kungus would never have agreed to this if he didn't think we Ethiopians could shield you when the hammer falls.
The stiff face became a black mask, as hard and unyielding as Kungus's own.
Which it will, and very soon.
Irene's eyes began to move toward the ridge above them, but she forced them aside. Izana, seeing the movement, nodded.
He will be there, Irene. Kungus will come.
Irene, trying to settle her nerves, fastened on that image. Kungus and his hard face coming toward her. Kungus smiling with his eyes as she corrected his grammar. The little twitch in his lips before he made a jest about thick-headed Kushans, even though she herself had been astonished by his ability to learn anything quickly. Kungus, day after day after day, sitting by her side in a chamber, learning to read. Never complaining, never grumbling, never angry at her for his own shortcomings. The memory of a hard face and clear almond eyes, and a heart beating hidden warmth and humor, and a mind like an uncut diamond steadied her. She took a few deep breaths.
Kungus will come.
A few more breaths.
He will.
A few more.
Kungus.
She felt herself return. To the memory of a hard face, she added her own irrepressible humor.
What do you think, Izana? She asked, gesturing with her chin toward the cluster of officers not more than 30 yards away.
The Malwa was still staring at her, exchanging unheard quips.
Will they start the seduction with fine wine? Some music, perhaps?
Izana chuckled. Irene snorted.
Not likely, is it?
Her sour gaze fell on one particularly gross Malwa officer. The man had his tongue sticking out, wagging it at her.
Will you look at...
The officer's eyes bulged. Blood coughed out of his mouth, coating the obscene tongue. An arrowhead was protruding through his throat. An instant later, the clustered officers were swept off their horses as if struck by a giant sickle. Irene gaped. Part of her mind identified the objects which had turned men into shredded meat. Arrows. But most of her brain simply went blank. Dimly, she heard Izana shouting. Her mouth still wide open from shock, she turned her head. The Syrian gunners had abandoned their servile toil and were already hurling grenades. The missiles were joined in mid-flight and then overtaken by 400 javelins. Ethiopia's spearmen were also in action. The javelin volley swept the front ranks of the Malwa mob like another great sickle. The second volley was on its way before the grenades even landed. Again, death swung its sickle, and then again, as the grenades began exploding in the packed crowd. Some of the grenades were smoke bombs. Within seconds, the bloody scene began to disappear behind streaked and wafting clouds. She was in a daze. Irene had never been in a battle before. She'd never been near a battle before. Part of her shock and confusion was produced by simple fear, but most of it was an even simpler collapse of intelligence. Irene's well-trained, logical mind stumbled and tripped, trying to find order and reason in the bedlam around her. Everything seemed pure chaos, an inferno of unreason. Through the eddying smoke, she caught glimpses of men dying, Sarwen locking their shields, the flight of arrows and javelins and grenades, Gelinkrushans charging down the slope, bellowing Yetai desperately trying to rally confused troops, shouts of confusion, shrieks of agony, screams of death and despair, cries of victory and triumph. Noise. Noise everywhere. Steel and wood and flesh breaking. She clapped her hands over her ears in her own desperate struggle to rally intelligence. Half in a crouch, sheltered under a canopy, she forced her eyes to watch. Desperately, desperately trying to find a place where reason could set its anchor. The anchor scraped across stone, finding no place. How can men stand this? She wondered. Her eyes recognized purpose in the chaos. Her eyes saw the discipline of the Sarwen, the way their shield wall held like a dike. And no pitiful child's castle of sand, this, against the coming tide. Her eyes saw, she had been told but had never really believed, how the Mawa broke against those shields and spears. Men, enemies, yes, but still men, using their own flesh like water, trying to break the reef. Flesh became red ruin, blood everywhere. A severed arm here, a coil of intestines there, a piece of Mawa brain crushed under an Ethiopian sandal. Irene's eyes watched Satan spread his carpet across a dusty road in India. She saw, but her mind couldn't encompass the seeing. A powerful hand seized her shoulder and drove her to her knees. Down, woman! Her ears heard Azana's voice shouting further commands. Her eyes saw five Sarwen surrounding her like a wall. Her mind understood nothing. She was no more than a child now, recognizing shelter. She closed her eyes and pressed her hands over her ears. Finally, darkness and relative quiet brought back a modicum of reason. In that small eye of the storm, Irene sought herself. After a time, seconds, minutes, hours, she began to recognize herself. Courage, foundation of all virtues, came back first. I will not do this. Firmly, she opened her eyes and removed her hands from her ears. She could see nothing on her knees except a few glimpses through the legs of the Sarwen standing guard over her. And what little else she could see was still obscured by smoke. After a moment, she stopped trying to make sense of the battle. She simply studied the legs of the soldiers shielding her. Excellent legs, she concluded. Under the black skin, powerful muscles flexed calves and thighs. The easy movement of men watching, not fighting themselves, but ready to spring into action at an instant's notice. Human leopards. Horny, calloused feet rested firmly in sturdy sandals. Toes, shaped in Ethiopia's mountains, fit stony Maharashtra to perfection. She listened to their banter. Her gaze was good enough now to understand the words, but her mind made no attempt to translate. Most of the words were profanity, anyway. Nothing more than taunting curses hurled down on the invisible enemy. She simply listened to the confidence in those voices. Human leopards growling with predator satisfaction. Two phrases only did she ever remember. The first howled with glee. And will you look at those fucking Kushans? God damn! And the response, growling bemused wonder. I'm glad Kungus is on our side, boys, or we'd be so much dog food. So am I. Oh, dear God. So am I. In the time which followed, as a Malwa army was ripped to pieces between Ethiopia's shield wall and a Kushan avalanche, Irene went away. This wasn't her place. She had no purpose here. She needed to find herself again, for perhaps the first time in her life.
herself appeared and demanded the truth.
Don't ask why you came, woman. You know the answer. And don't tell me lies about clever stratagems and ruses and battle plans. Tell others, but not me. You know why you came.
Yes, she choked, closing her eyes. Tears leaked through the lids.
I know.
Asarwen, hearing the soft sobs, glanced down at her. For a moment, no more, before he looked away. A woman, her wits shattered, nothing to puzzle over. Women were fragile by nature. But he was quite wrong. The tears streaking Irene's cheeks were tears of happiness, not fear. Fear there was, of course, and fear aplenty. But it wasn't fear of the moment. No, not at all. It was the much greater fear, the deep terror entwined with joy, of a human being who had finally, like so many others before her, been able to give up a hostage to fortune. A woman who finally understood her friend Antonina and could finally make the same choice.
He would have gone into the fire anyway, she whispered to herself, no matter what I did.
Herself nodded.
And you could not bear the thought of staying behind, staring at a horse.
Then he was there. She saw the legs of the Sarwen around her ease and stretch, saw them move aside, heard the shouts of greeting and glee. In the distance, a muted roar. The first of the Malwa guns was being destroyed, overcharged powder blowing overcharged shot, rupturing the huge weapon like a rotten fruit. He squatted next to her where she knelt.
Are you all right?
Irene nodded, smiled. He placed a hand on her shoulder. He had never touched her before. She reached up and caressed the hand with her own, feeling with her long and slender fingers the short ones, heavy with flesh and sinew which held her shoulder so gently. She pressed her face into his thick chest. His hand slid down her arm. His arm became a shield, his touch an embrace. Suddenly, fiercely, she pressed open lips against his muscular neck, kissing, nuzzling. Her breath came quick and short. She flung her arms around him and drew him half sprawling across her. Her left leg, kicking free of the long tunic, coiled down his outthrust right leg. Her sandal scraped the bare skin of his calf. For a moment, pure heat bolting out of a stable like a wild horse, Irene felt Kunkus respond. His hard abdomen pressed her own, desire meeting desire. But only for a moment. Kunkus chuckled. The sound carried more delight than humor. Much more. Much more. It was the choked laugh of a man who discovers unexpectedly that an idle dream has taken real form. Yet despite that little cry, his strong arms and body went rigid, pinning her, not like a wrestler pins an opponent, but simply like a man restrains a child from folly. Seconds went by while his lips nuzzled her lovely, thick chestnut hair. Irene felt his breath, heavy, hot at first, but cooling quickly. She chuckled herself then, as his restraint brought her own.
I guess it's not a good idea, she mumbled. The Ethiopians would probably insist on watching.
Worse, I'm afraid, he responded dryly, still kissing her hair. They'd accompany us with drums, placing bets all the while on when we'd stop.
Irene laughed outright. The sound was muffled against his chest.
No, whispered Kunkus gently. Not for us, and not now. Passion always comes after death's wings flap away. But it is cheap and gone with the morrow, and you will wonder afterward whether it was you or your fear.
He chuckled again. Delight was still in that sound, but it was warm rather than ecstatic.
I know you, Irene. You would resent me. And what's worse, you would study books trying to find the answer.
Think I couldn't find it? She demanded.
She heard his soft laugh rustling through her hair, felt the little movement of his chest, knew the economic subtlety she had come to cherish so.
I don't doubt you would, but reading takes so much time. I don't want to wait that long.
Smiling, she raised her head. The clear brown eyes of Greek nobility, looking past a long and bony nose, stared into eyes of almond in a flat and barbarous face.
How long, then? She asked.
Another muted roar swept the pavilion, and then another. But the Gushan's eyes never left her own. The destruction of Venantakatra's guns, the rubble of Malwa's schemes, the salvation of a dynasty, these were meaningless things in that moment for those two people embracing on a road.
"First, I must learn to read," he said. "Not before."
His face was stiff and solemn, but Irene didn't miss the little twitch in his lips. She smiled.
"You're a good student, you know. Amazingly good."
Kungus's smile could have been recognized by anyone now.
"With such an incentive, who could fail?"
There was another roar as a siege gun ruptured, and another. This time, Kungus did look.
"That's the last of them," he said. "We must be off now before they rally and Venantakatra sends more. We can make the coast if we don't dawdle."
With easy grace, he rose to his feet and extended his hand. A moment later, Irene was standing at his side. The realities of war had returned. Irene could see the Sarwen and the Kushan troops forming their columns in preparation for the forced march to the sea, and the Ethiopian ships waiting there to carry them back to Supara. But Kungus didn't immediately relinquish his grip on her hand. He took the time to lean over and whisper.
"We will know."
Irene, grinning, squeezed his hand.
"Yes, we will always know."
She burst into laughter then. Riotous, joy-filled laughter. Ethiopian and Kushan soldiers nearby, hearing that bizarre sound on a bloody battlefield, looked her way. For a second or two, no more. A woman, her wits frayed by the carnage. Nothing to puzzle over. Women were fragile by nature. Chapter 19. Persia. Summer, 532 AD. "Can you disguise the entrance afterward?" asked Belisarius. He waved his hand in a gesture which encompassed the valley. "The whole area, actually. Keep in mind, Carus, there'll be more than 10,000 soldiers passing through here, and as many horses." The Roman general turned his head, looking down at the river. The river flowed west by northwest. Like the valley itself, the river was small and rather narrow. The pass where it exited the valley was barely more than a gorge. They were almost in the foothills of the western slope of the Zagros, but the surrounding mountains seemed to have lost none of their usual ruggedness. "I assume you'll be taking the horses out that way," Belisarius said, pointing toward the gorge. "By the time they pass through, the whole valley will be churned into mush, no way to disguise the tracks." Kurush shook his head, smiling.
"We won't try to hide the tracks, Belisarius, quite the opposite.
The more Demotor's mind is on that gorge, the more he'll be diverted from the real exit." Belisarius scratched his chin. "I understand the logic, Kurush, but don't underestimate Demotor and Sangha and their scouts. Those Pathan trackers can trail a mouse. They won't simply trot after the horses salivating. They'll search the entire valley." Belisarius turned his head and studied the entrance to the Qanat. The timber braced at it was located about 100 yards up the mountainside, not far from the small river which had carved out this valley. The sloping ramp, after a few feet, disappeared into darkness. He hooked a thumb in that direction. "There'll be tracks there, too," he pointed out. "No way to disguise them, either. Even if you collapse the entrance, the tracks will be all over the area. 10,000 troops leave a big trail." Karusha's smile widened. He shook his head.
"You're worrying too much.
We can cover the soldiers' tracks by running the horses through afterward, everywhere except this immediate area. Then..." The Persian nobleman leapt onto a small rock a few feet away. From that perch, he leaned over and pointed along the steep slope of the mountain.
"This is mining country, Belisarius. Silver, mostly. There are small deposits in this valley."
He spread his hands apologetically. "Nothing more than traces, really, according to the miners I brought with me. But the miners will be gone before Demotor arrives, and I doubt very much if an army of Rajput cavalrymen will be able to tell him that the ore in the area isn't worth mining." Aid made a mental snort.
"Rajputs?"
Belisarius chuckled. "Hardly. And their Pathans, outside of hunting, consider all forms of labor to be women's work." The Roman general nodded.
"Yes, that'll work.
After we pass through, you'll have this whole slope turned into a mining operation.
Cover our tracks with tailings.
He pointed at the adit. And I assume that you'll have your miners cover our tracks well into the canard. 50 yards should do it. Batans are outdoorsmen. They won't be comfortable more than a few feet into that blackness. Again, Belisarius studied the gorge at the far end of the valley. All that will be left after a few days, he mused, are the tracks of Roman horses, passing by pure coincidence through a mining area on their way into Mesopotamia. He paused, thinking. One thing, however. Those Batans know their business, Carouche. You'll have to make sure... Carouche was grinning. Yes, yes, he interrupted. I'll have the horses carrying sacks filled with dirt, weighing about what a Roman soldier does. Their tracks will be deep enough.
Belisarius returned the grin with one of his own.
You've thought of everything, I see.
Carouche shrugged. Belisarius almost laughed. The modest gesture fit the Aryan Sardaran about as well as a curtsy fits a lion. His humor faded.
You understand, Carouche, that the hammer will fall on you. Once Demodera understands what has happened, and it won't take him long, he won't waste time trying to chase after me. He'll strike directly into Mesopotamia.
Carouche shrugged again. The gesture this time didn't even pretend at modesty. It was the twitch of a lion's shoulders irritated by flies.
That's only fair, Roman, after all you've done for the Aryans.
Carouche sprang off the rock and strode over to Belisarius. He jabbed his chin toward the south, using his stiff Persian-cut beard as a pointer. As soon as he gets the word, the Emperor will begin retreating toward Babylon. He's on the verge of doing it anyway, so it won't seem odd at all.
Carouche scowled. The Malwa have been pressing him very hard.
Belisarius eyed the Sardaran. The Roman general had no difficulty interpreting Carouche's frowning face. He could well imagine the casualties which Emperor Khosrow's soldiers had taken over the past months. While Belisarius had been maneuvering with Demodera in the Zagros Mountains all through the spring, Khosrow had been keeping the huge main army of the Malwa invasion penned up in the Tigris-Euphrates Delta. The task would have been difficult enough even without... He decided to broach the awkward subject. As the rebellion... Carouche's frown vanished instantly. The Persian nobleman barked a laugh. The head of the emperor's half-brother has been the main ornament of his pavilion for 2 weeks now.
Carouche grimaced. Damn thing was a mass of flies by the time I left. Stinky.
His good humor returned. Ormazd's rebellion has been crushed, and that of the Lakhmids. We took Hira almost 2 months ago. Khosrow drove the population into the desert and ordered the city razed to the ground. Belisarius let no sign of his distaste show. He had never been fond of punitive action against enemy civilians, even before he met aid and was introduced to future standards of war-making. But he didn't fault Khosrow. But the standards of the day, in truth, driving the population of Hira out of the city before destroying it was rather humane. The Lakhmids had been Persian vassals before they gave their allegiance to the Malwa invaders. Most Persian emperors, most Roman ones for that matter, including Theodora, would have repaid that rebellion by ordering the city's people burned inside it. And let's not get too romantic about the Geneva Convention and the supposedly civilized standards of future wars either, remarked Aid. They won't prevent entire cities being destroyed with their populations, purely for strategic reasons, of course. What difference does that make to mangled children in the ruins of Coventry, or to thousands of Korean slave laborers incinerated at Hiroshima? Carouche was pointing with his beard again, this time to the west. The Emperor has instructed me to defend Ctesiphon while he retreats to Babylon. I will have 10,000 men. That should be enough to hold our capital city for a few months. Demodera doesn't have siege guns. Carouche turned his eyes to Belisarius. There was nothing in the Persian's gaze beyond a matter-of-fact acceptance of reality.
In the end, of course, he said calmly, we will be doomed, unless your thrust strikes home.
Belisarius smiled crookedly.
It is said that an army marches on its belly, you know. I will do my best to drive a lance into the great gut of Malwa once you've drawn the shield away.
Carouche chuckled.
An army marches on its belly, he repeated. That's clever. I don't recognize the saying, though. Who came up with it?
Good move, genius, said Aid sourly. This will be entertaining, watching you explain to a 6th-century Persian how you came to quote Napoleon.
Belisarius ignored the quip.
I heard it from a Hun, one of my mercenaries during my second campaign in the Trans-Danube. I was rather stunned, actually, to find such a keen grasp of logistics in the mind of a barbarian, but it just goes to show. Father of lies, father of lies. It's a good thing my lips are sealed, so to speak. The stories I could tell about you. They'd make even Procopius's secret history look like sober, reasoned truth.
Lord Demodera leaned back in his chair, studying Narsi's scowling face.
So what is it that bothers you exactly? He asked the eunuch.
Everything, snapped Narses.
The old Roman glared around the interior of the pavilion as if searching its unadorned walls for some nook or cranny in which truth lay hidden.
None of what Belisarius is doing makes any sense, stated Narses. Nothing, not from the large to the small.
Explain, commanded Demodera.
The lord waved his pudgy little hand in a circular motion. The gesture included himself and the tall figure of the Rajput king seated next to him.
In simple words, that two simpletons like myself and Ranasanga can understand.
The good-humored quip caused even Ranasanga to smile. Even Narses, for that matter, and the old eunuch wasn't a man who smiled often.
As to the large, said Narses, what is the purpose of these endless maneuvers that Belisarius is so fond of?
The eunuch leaned forward, emphasizing his next words.
Which are not, however, and cannot be, truly endless. There is no way he can stop you from reaching Mesopotamia. A man's not a fool. That must be obvious to him by now.
Narses jabbed a stiff finger toward the pavilion's entrance.
As it is to the most dim-witted Yetai in your army.
He's bought time, remarked Sanga.
Narses made a sour face.
A few months at most. It's not been more than 8 weeks since the Battle of the Pass, and you've already forced him almost out of the Zagros. Your army is much bigger than his. You can defeat him on an open battlefield, and you've proven that you can maneuver through these mountains as well as he can. Within a month, perhaps 6 weeks, he'll have to concede the contest and allow you entry into Mesopotamia, at which point he'll have no choice but to fort up in Ctesiphon or Perosia-Por anyway. So why not do it now?
I don't think it's odd, countered Demodera.
He's used the months that he kept us tied up in the Zagros to good advantage, according to our spies. That general of his that he left in charge of the Roman forces in Mesopotamia, the crippled one, Agathias, has been working like a fiend these past months. By the time we get to Ctesiphon or Perosia-Por, he'll have the cities fortified beyond belief. Cannons and gunpowder have been pouring in from the Roman armories while we've been countermarching all over these damn mountains. Sanga nodded.
The whole campaign, to my mind, has Belisarius's signature written all over it. He always tries to force his enemy to attack him so that he can have the advantage of the defensive. By stalling us for so many months here in the mountains, he's been able to create a defensive stronghold in Mesopotamia. It'll be pure murder trying to storm Perosia-Por.
Narses stared at the two men sitting across the table from him. There seemed to be no expression at all on the eunuch's wizened, scaly face, but both Demodera and Sanga could sense the sarcasm lurking somewhere inside. Neither man took offense. They were accustomed to Narses and his ways by now. There was bitterness at the center of the eunuch's soul which was ineradicable. That bitterness colored his examination of the world and gave scorn to his every thought. Thoughts, however, and a capacity to examine, which they had come to respect deeply. And so a kinsman of the Malwa dynasty and Rajputana's most noble monarch listened carefully to the words of a low-born Roman eunuch. Narses leaned over and pointed with his finger to a location on the great map which covered the table.
He will make his stand at Perosia-Por, not Ctesiphon, predicted Narses. Belisarius is a Roman, when all is said and done. Ctesiphon is Persia's capital, but Perosia-Por is the gateway to the Roman Empire.
Demodera and Sanga both nodded. They had already come to the same conclusion. Narses studied the map for a few seconds. Then,
tell me something. When the time comes, do you intend to hurl your soldiers at the wall of Perosia-Por?
He almost, not quite, sneered.
You don't have too many Yetai left either, so the soldiers you'll use up like sheep at a slaughterhouse will all be Rajput.
Ranasanga didn't rise to the bait. He simply chuckled. Demodera laughed outright.
Not likely, exclaimed the Mawa lord. He leaned over the table himself. The months of arduous campaigning had shrunk Demodera's belly enough that the movement was almost graceful. Demodera's finger traced the Tigris River from Ctesiphon upstream toward Armenia. I won't go near Peroz-Shapur, another laugh. Any more than I'd enter a tiger's cage. I won't try to besiege Ctesiphon either. I'll simply use the Tigris to keep my army supplied and move north into Assyria. From there, I can strike into Anatolia or Armenia, while most of Khosrow's army is tied up fighting our main force on the southern Euphrates. He leaned back, exuding self-satisfaction. Belisarius will have no choice, pronounced Demodera. All that work he's done to fortify Peroz-Shapur will be wasted. He'll have to come out and face me somewhere in the field. Narsi's eyes left Demodera and settled on Ranasanga. The Rajput king nodded his agreement with Demodera's explication.
Ah, said Narses, an excellent strategy. I am enlightened. Except, why hasn't Belisarius figured the same thing out himself? The man has never, to put it mildly, been accused of stupidity.
Silence. Demodera squirmed a bit in his chair. Sangha maintained his usual stiff composure, but the very rigidity of the posture indicated his own discomfort. Narsi sneered.
Ah, yes. You've wondered that yourselves, haven't you? Now and again, at least.
The eunuch relinquished the sneer within a few seconds. He was too canny to risk offending the two men across the table from him, and if the truth be told, he had a genuine respect for them.
Let's leave that broad problem for a moment and move on to some seemingly minor questions. Of these, there are three that stand out.
Narses held up a thumb.
First, why has Belisarius, since the very beginning of this campaign in the Zagros, always been willing to let us move north?
Narses turned toward the Rajput.
As Ranasanga was the first to point out many weeks ago.
He gave another nod, this time to Demodera.
As you yourself remarked at the time, Lord, that makes no sense. It should be the other way around. We should be fighting like a tiger when we move north and put up only token resistance when we maneuver to the south. That way he would be keeping us from threatening Assyria.
Silence. Narses held up his forefinger alongside the thumb.
The second small problem. In all the skirmishes we fought over the past months, even during the battle at the pass when his situation was desperate, Belisarius has never used his mercenaries. Why? He's got 2,000 of the Goth barbarians, but he handles them like they were the only jewels in his possession.
Sangha cleared his throat.
Doesn't trust them, I imagine.
The Rajput king scowled.
I don't trust mercenaries either, Narses.
The eunuch snorted.
Of course you don't,